Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Prove Me Wrong podcast. As always, I'm your host, Pete Lieb. I'm glad you're with me again tonight. I have a great show lined up tonight. We are going to take a history lesson tonight. My guest is Mr. Randy Crable, and he is going to discuss his book, Tulsa 1921, which tells the story of the Tulsa Race Massacre, one of the most tragic and blatant examples of racism that wasn't taught in my school growing up, and as far as I can tell, isn't taught in any school, maybe outside of Tulsa itself, and I'll ask Randy about that. History, though, seems under attack right now in the United States. The prevailing feeling is, it seems to me, that history should not be remembered or learned from, good and bad, but erased completely and forgotten if it offends even one person. An individual's entire life, all of their good works and accomplishments can be canceled based on one instance of bad judgment or a practice that may have been socially acceptable at the time but is now widely condemned as it should be. Monuments and statues are being vandalized, removed, or both, essentially because of the duality of man, and there really is no one perfect human, myself or any of us included. And there is a saying that goes something like, history is written by the victors. And largely, I would assume that to be true. History is written in a way that would put the best possible light on those who are writing it and selectively omit circumstances that may illuminate some of the darker sides of who we are. Because again, no one person is perfect. But normally, if we are honest with ourselves, we're able to revisit and remember those events, those darker times, no matter how painful it is, and learn from them and be better people going forward. So once again, those who do not remember history are doomed to repeat it. So tonight, Randy and I are going to revisit one of the dark corners of our collective past, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, in the hopes of never repeating it. Randy Crable is an Oklahoma native and a graduate of Oklahoma State University. He arrived at the Tulsa World in 1979 as a sports writer and has remained there ever since. He's reported on a wide range of topics, including college football, boxing, politics, and the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. In 1999, he was assigned to coverage of the Tulsa Race Riot, a panel established by the Oklahoma legislature to investigate the events of May 31 through June 1, 1921, and their aftermath. This began two decades of research and reporting that became the basis of the book that we're going to talk about tonight, Tulsa 1921, Reporting a Massacre, which was published in September of 2019 and will be the basis of the discussion we're going to have tonight. The book was named Oklahoma Department of Library's Nonfiction Book of the Year and the Oklahoma Historical Society's Book of the Year. Randy lives in Tulsa, where he continues to report on issues related to race and the race massacre, as well as national politics and government. He's a member of the Oklahoma Journalism Hall of Fame. You can find more on Randy on his website, randycrable.com. You can also find his book on amazon.com. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and say welcome, Randy, to the Prove Me Wrong podcast. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Could you start me off just a little bit more? I know I gave a little bit of a bio there, but can you start me off a little more of your history? You started with the Tulsa World as a sports writer. How did you transition into politics?
There were a couple of intermediate steps, but I was a sports writer until early in 1993, and then I moved over to the news side. I covered actually higher education for a while, and then I became kind of a special assignment reporter. Mm-hmm. I basically for the city editor and did whatever they needed me to do, and that eventually included covering the Race Riot Commission, as it was known then. And since then, I've just sort of evolved into covering a number of things.
Well, again, we talked about it just briefly before you and I came on the air, and I had never heard of the Tulsa Race Riot. I'm from Ohio originally, so it was not something that was ever taught in my school. Actually, I found out about it maybe 6 months ago. I was watching a television show called Lovecraft Country on HBO. You may have seen it, you may not have. They had an episode which the circumstances involved the race riots in Tulsa. And I watched this episode and I said, there's no way this happened. This didn't actually happen, right? This is a fictional account. And so I went on Google just to make sure that it was fictional. And sure enough, it had really happened. And I had never heard of it. And I'm 47 years old. So that's when I went online and I said, okay, who can I find to talk to about this? So can you describe, for those who aren't familiar, what the Greenwood District of Tulsa is and some of the history of that area?
All right. Well, the Greenwood area originated at the corner of Greenwood and Archer. And at the time, it really began about 1905. Mm-hmm. City of Tulsa goes back to about 1882, but it wasn't incorporated until 1898. It was platted shortly after that. And so at that time, Greenwood and Archer were in the northeast corner of the town, and it pretty quickly grew beyond the city limits. And it was the area where the black population for the most part lived, and it developed into a really active business district. And people sort of made an agreement or a pact that they were going to keep their money in their community as much as possible, and they did business with each other, and that was pretty significant at that time, because to a large extent, black populations in the United States had very little economic independence. Mm-hmm. In other words, you work for white people. You've had to buy everything from white people. If you sold something, you probably sold it to a white person. So the ability to have your own business and to have some sort of independence, both economically and politically, was a pretty big deal.
So were they able, was this just, how was the community built? How was the economy built? Were they producing things, or was it a kind of a circular economy where, people worked at certain customer service roles that then serviced other folks who then worked at customer service roles? How did that economy work?
Well, it acquired the name of Black Wall Street, but really, it was more like a black Main Street. And so there were a lot of small businesses, hotels, some cafes, not really any financial institutions. It wasn't really like Wall Street. There weren't banks or anything like that. And most of the people who lived there did work in the white world. I mean, they were, again, the limitations on the black population, I think we don't really appreciate today. I didn't appreciate what they were, really. It was something I knew on kind of an intellectual level, but I didn't really comprehend it until I, started working on this. So the kinds of occupations that the black people could have were pretty limited. And so they did work, they worked for wages. They were domestics, cooks, mechanics, laborers. Mm-hmm. Some of them worked on the railroad. There was a professional class in Greenwood, some doctors, some lawyers, teachers, clergymen, and, but again, they were limited because, their clients were the other African Americans. They weren't their clients or patients were not rich white people on the other side of the railroad tracks. So it was you hear different numbers, but the bottom line was that money turned over many times in Greenwood. In other words, somebody would bring their wages back, and they'd go to the local stores and buy groceries and clothes, and get their hair cut, and go to the movies. There were some theaters there and things like that. And that stayed in the community, and then those people used that money, and they, you know, so it just it circulated in the community.
What was the population at its zenith? What was the population of Greenwood at that time?
Well, Greenwood actually reached its peak. It rebuilt after the massacre, and it reached its peak after World War II.
Okay.
But in 1921, there were probably 7,000 or 8,000 people living there.
You got a phone?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Oh, no problem. All right. So what were the relations like between the white and black sections of, you said that the Greenwood, as they became more prosperous, they began to expand. What were the relations like between those two different sections of the city? Because they were truly segregated, basically, what you're saying, yes?
Yes, it was. Now, there were quite a few black people who actually lived in the white section of town because they lived in servants' quarters.
Okay.
And there was a fairly large black rural population. But in terms of Greenwood and the white population, there had not been any real overt conflict. But, you know, the situation was this. And several things were happening all at one time.
Okay.
So Tulsa, you know, Tulsa went from about 2,000 people in 1898 to over 75,000 people in 1920. It grew really rapidly. Wow. because of oil. It was the financial and manufacturing and transportation center of what's called the Mid-Continent oil field. And there was a lot of money went through that city during World War I because of all the oil that was going to the war effort. So there was a lot of money. Some of that translated into more money for black folks. And then in 1919 and 1920, several things happened. One is that you had black World War veterans returning home. And, you know, they just fought, you know, the war to make the world safe for democracy. And they'd like to see some of that democracy at home.
Yeah.
You know? And then also there was a pretty severe recession or depression really throughout the country because you had all these war veterans coming home looking for work. Commodity prices had been high. Wages had been high during the war and all of that. And so all of that just pretty much collapsed. All of these things were creating tensions. You'd gone through the period during the Wilson administration when segregation and discrimination had actually increased. You know, a few weeks before the massacre, the riot, there were a couple of there was an elderly black couple who were arrested for refusing to give up their seats on the streetcar in Tulsa, and it didn't get much attention.
Mm-hmm.
I've long wondered if there wasn't something pretty telling about that little piece of information. So I think these tensions were rising. There's also, you know, another thing that was going on throughout the war. There was kind of a vigilante element to life in Tulsa and really throughout a lot of the country, because you had a lot of this, you know, America First and not America First, 100% Americanism. That was the deal. The Ku Klux Klan, the second Klan had been organized. Just a lot of sort of tensions below the surface. And whites tended to look at Greenwood as pretty much a slum. But blacks looked at it as a place that was a lot better than most of the places they had come from. Mm-hmm. And it was a place of opportunity for them. And it was a, I think as much as anything, it was a place where they had a certain amount of independence and self-determination.
So what was the actual event that, you know, we talked about some tensions building and some of the factors that ultimately precipitated what happened? But what was the specific? Was there a specific event that led them to say, okay, you know, we're going to go across, we're going to cross the line? And I don't know if they meant that for this to happen, for what happened to actually go down. But what was it that led to May 31st?
I think it's kind of a series of things. Uh-huh. That if there had been intervention or one of them it had not happened, you know, maybe the whole thing would not have happened. But at any rate, you know, the sort of the accepted story is that on the morning of May 30th, actually, which was a Memorial Day, a young black man who was identified as Dick Rowland got on an elevator in a downtown office building. And the building was pretty empty because, again, it was a holiday. And Memorial Day was a really big holiday in those days because it was just after the war.
Right,
and so you had a war dead and everything. Everybody was trying to prove how patriotic they were. So the building was pretty empty. He got on the elevator and a young white girl was operating it. And on the way down, she screamed. And when the elevator got to the first floor, Dick Rowland took off running. There was a bystander there who called the police. And so after an investigation, the next day, on May 31st, the Tulsa police arrested Dick Rowland and brought him in. And reportedly on a charge of attempted assault assault, which in the language of the day meant rape or attempted rape. And this was the kind of thing that had gotten a lot of black men killed. Mm-hmm. In the United States, and especially in the South, over the last, forever really, but yeah. Especially in recent years, there'd been an uptick in violence. And, so everybody was kind of on edge. And in the Tulsa Tribune, which was the afternoon paper, ran a story on the front page. It was not a banner headline, but it was a kind of an eye-grabbing headline. And I would say sensationalized. It really, it was pretty loaded. The language was pretty loaded. And So some black folks read this and thought, okay, they're going to try and do something with Dick Rowland. And in fact, the police commissioner said he received a telephone call from somebody who said, we're going to get this guy. And I should mention that there had actually been a lynching from the Tulsa County Jail the previous summer. And on that same summer, a black man had been lynched, taken from the Oklahoma County Jail, which is Oklahoma City, and lynched. This was the same weekend. And that had prompted some of the black leaders in Tulsa to say, well, they are not going to do that to one of our guys. So Dick Rowland was put in the Tulsa County Jail. It was actually a pretty secure jail. It was on the top floor of the courthouse. It was difficult to get into. The man who'd been lynched the previous year, they accomplished that by taking the then sheriff hostage. I think there was some suspicion that maybe it was kind of an inside deal. The sheriff had changed in the interim, and the sheriff in 1921 was pretty adamant that they were not going to take Dick Rowland. So at any rate, white crowds started gathering around the courthouse, kept getting bigger and bigger. And then some black men who were determined that nothing was going to happen to Dick Rowland showed up. They were armed. That got the crowd more upset. And at this point, you know, today we would expect law enforcement and the National Guard to show up and, you know, try and disperse the crowd.
Right.
And it didn't happen. It was basically the white sheriff and his black deputy out on the courthouse steps trying to get several hundred people to go home. And initially, the black men did go home, but they kept hearing, but the white crowd would never disperse, so the black men came back. And eventually, someone, and it appears to have been a disappointed office seeker, somebody who thought he should be sheriff, tried to disarm one of the black men, and the gun went off, and at that point, you know, all bets were off.
Yeah.
And then early the next morning, there was the authorities, they had about 35 or 40 National Guardsmen, some police officers, some civilians went in, and they started taking into custody all of the black residents they could find. And anybody who, you know, put up a fight and shot at them, was shot. And so, you know, some people were killed at that point. After they, you know, and then a lot of black folks had just fled, you mm-hmm. know, because of what was going on. So in the wake of this, arson squads, as they were called, men with torches and inflammable material came in and burned it down. They burned 35 square blocks. It's absolutely devastated. If you've ever seen pictures of Hiroshima, it kind of looks like that, actually.
So you're saying initially, National Guard came in. It wasn't just townsfolk. It was literally right. They had National Guards, 40 National Guardmen, come in and just arresting everybody, anybody who happened to be there.
Yeah, well, black folks.
Right, right.
So the explanation that was given was that they decided they didn't have enough men that they could trust to get between the whites and the blacks. They'd been fighting all night long, shooting back and forth across the railroad tracks and from neighboring neighborhoods. There'd been gunfire going on all night. There'd been some attempts to set some fires in the black neighborhood. So the decision was made to go in and at least try and take all the black people who were left into custody, ostensibly for their own protection, and try and resolve it that way.
And then shoot the ones who didn't want to be protected.
And shoot the, well, so the theory was, is that if you resisted, you have to understand this whole thing quickly became perceived as a Negro uprising, uh-huh. a black uh-huh. insurrection, whatever you want to call it. So the Greenwood was not burned because of what happened between Dick Rowland and Sarah Page. It was burned because of these guys who went to the courthouse, because nothing, I mean, I don't want to be flip about this, but it's true. In that day and age, nothing scared white people more than black men with guns.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that these black men would be so bold as to come right through the white downtown to the courthouse with guns was just something that could, for some white people, was just something that could not be countenanced. And, you know, I think they, you know, some of these people decided, okay, these black folks, they think they're big stuff. You know, they think they have some money and they think they have some independence and they have their houses and their stores and their business district and all that stuff, but we can take it away in an instant. And that's what they set about to do. And, you know, there's a lot of debate as to what role the authorities played in that, whether it was active or passive, but in the end, you know, Greenwood was destroyed.
These arson squads, were they also sanctioned by the police department, or were they just concerned citizens who decided, I'm going to go in and burn down Greenwood?
Well, that's been a matter of debate for 100 years.
And
according to testimony, some of the members of those arson squads were police officers, most of them out of uniform. And in fact, in the aftermath of all of this, of course, people filed the insurance claims. Well, those were all or almost all denied because most of them didn't cover riots. The insurance policies didn't cover riots. There were attempts to try and prove that the city or maybe the county or the state were liable. And so all of that led to what today we'd call a test case. And this was actually a white property owner. There were white property owners in Greenwood. And one of them was a guy named William Redfern. He owned several businesses there. He sued his insurance company. And he tried to prove that this was sanctioned by the city and the state. And while they were able to show, as I said, that some police officers were involved in this arson, they never could quite come up with the evidence that this was ordered by anybody in authority, that the mayor or the police chief or the city commission or anybody like that actually ordered them or organized or in any way planned that. But so it's all left to conjecture. And, you know, people have different opinions on that.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, it's really hard to prove one way or another.
So we found out that seven of the people in these arson squads were off-duty police officers. Were there any legal repercussions to any of those people that they actually knew?
No. What would happen in testimony was, well, we saw these guys and we recognize them as police officers, but we don't know their names. I mean, you kind of got the impression that witnesses were intimidated. I mean, that's my impression.
Uh-huh.
Anyway. So there were actually a lot of people who were arrested, mostly black, but white too, for various crimes, including arson. One guy that was arrested, he went by the name of Cowboy Long, and he was a pretty notorious outlaw and really kind of a underworld type figure. But in the end, nobody really, there was one guy, a black guy, who went to prison on a gun violation that he claimed was trumped up. But, you know, for all practical purposes, nothing was really done. There was a lot of passion and a lot of activity through the summer of 1921. It died out at the end of the summer, and then it pretty much descended, I guess you'd say, into this, you know, decades-long silence where people were either not inclined or afraid to talk about it.
So the reports that I've seen in terms of fatalities, it was somewhere around 300 fatalities. So if you're talking 7,000 population, 300 people is like 45% of, or no, sorry, 4%, 4.5% of the population was killed. Were those 300 people killed in the gunfighting early in the day, or were they able to determine, or were they part of the arson at the end of the day, or was it just kind of a mixture of both?
Yeah, well, so the fatalities is another thing that is the number 300 is used a lot these days.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter is nobody really knows how many people were killed. And they actually don't know the race of all the people killed because we have death certificates for 37. 12 of those are white and 25 are black. From the very start, there were, these reports of bodies being taken here and there and all over the place. The National Guard said they couldn't, they couldn't confirm how many people were killed. They said, we know of these, meaning what was ultimately the 37. But we can't speak about whether there are other people other places. And at the time, the estimates varied from 50 to 500. So to get to your original question, most of them would have been killed in that invasion on the morning of June 1st. I call it an invasion.
You know? Yeah.
Most of them would have been killed in that period. And for years after that, I mean, so sometimes you'd run across, oral histories, mainly from Black people who claim most of the people killed were white. And because what we had were war stories.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this was a war. And so what happens in war? Well, you minimize your own losses and you maximize the other side's losses. And all of this information is confusing and it's sometimes conflicting, but I think it's reasonable to say that, you know, we don't really know how many people were killed. It's almost certainly more than the 37 they have death certificates for. There could very easily be people buried in multiple places that aren't accounted for, and finding those is going to be very difficult.
Have they ever, and I say that just because I live in Northeast Florida, I live in near St. Augustine, Florida, and you can't dig anything in St. Augustine, Florida without coming across a body, right? There's just 400, 500 years worth of living and dying there.
Yeah.
Has there
in America, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You honestly can't. Every now and then you'll be seeing somebody fixing the sewer system on their store and they have to stop because they find bones. Has there been anything like that in that area where there've been development and they've been building something new or what have you, and they may find bones?
Well, nothing that's related to the massacre. Now, there is a story that goes back now a long way. There was a guy who told some researchers in the 90s, I think is when he told this story, or at least that's when they heard the story, that a guy, a white man as a young fella, had come across some bones that had been excavated near New Block Park, which is one of the areas that's been discussed as a possible burial place.
Mm-hmm.
But the details on that have never really been worked out or nailed down, and he's dead now. So
kind of covers that up.
Yeah, right. So that's kind of difficult.
I mean,
stuff like that happens, but not directly related to this. I mean, for instance, this town cemetery was moved in the early 1900s, and as it turns out, they didn't move everything.
Right.
So for 50 or 60 or more years, every time somebody did something over where the cemetery used to be, they'd occasionally come up with some remains, but there's never been any indication that they related to this incident.
Okay. So you're part of the press. And if I'm not mistaken, part of your brief when you started this research was to also see what the coverage was like from the press at the time and kind of investigate that and use that as part of your sources for your research. What did you find when you were researching, whether it be, I believe it was the Tulsa World, I believe that's one of them.
Tulsa World and the Tulsa Tribune.
Tulsa Tribune, yes, I'm sorry. What did you find in terms of their coverage of the event after the fact? How did they cover it? And then were there any Black publications or other Black sources of information and how did they differ?
Well, I was told by other people that, well, the newspapers didn't cover it at all. They just completely, or if they did cover it, you know, that all those papers are missing. So I went to my microfilm, or not my microfilm, but it's also, you know, our microfilm. The Tribune closed in 1992. Okay. So when I started researching this, the Tribune had closed. But we had all their microfilm. So I went to the microfilm and just started reading it because I thought that was a place to start. And so I was, you know, somewhat surprised to find there was a lot of information in the newspapers. In fact, the night and morning of the massacre, the World put out three extra editions besides their regular morning edition. And so there was a lot of information in there, but of course you had to read it critically. And, you know, it was almost all from a white point of view. And it was also to varying degrees, you know, newspapers in those days, today we complain about the media being too political. Well, you know, originally that's what they did. The
right,
media
right, was right.
Political. And so even in, you know, in the 1920s, these two competing newspapers had different interests and different angles and different, you know, perspectives, I guess you would say. And they reported on things a little differently. But generally, you know, they wanted to report accurately, but they also wanted to minimize the damage to the city's reputation. Tulsa was a very proud place. It had grown so quickly and, you know, had all these things going on. In terms of other publications, you know, that there had been, you know, the black newspaper, the Tulsa Star, mm-hmm. but it of course was destroyed, and the editor and publisher had fled because he was one of the people that was being blamed for what happened. There was a pretty influential newspaper in Oklahoma City called the Black Dispatch, and it reported on it. In fact, it published the story about Dick Rowland's arrest under the headline, "The Story That Set Tulsa Ablaze." In other words, they pinpointed that story. Mm-hmm. Walter White from the NAACP was in Tulsa within a few days of what happened. And he reported on it in The Crisis, which was, and still is, the NAACP's publication. There were some other publications, but I don't know that they were real reliable. Now, there were some, the New York Times reported quite a bit on it. They had a correspondent here, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported on it pretty thoroughly. They had a correspondent, that paper had a correspondent here too. So, but it was in papers all over the United States and in Europe.
What was the immediate aftermath like for the black community there? Obviously their entire area was burned down, essentially just obliterated. What was what was their process like for getting themselves? They ultimately rebuilt, right? They rebuilt the entire area, but they had challenges, right? The city of Tulsa put some zoning issues in their way. Can you talk about that as well? What that initial aftermath was like, and then the struggle they had to rebuild?
So the Tribune and some other people had, before the massacre, had been sort of campaigning against Greenwood and writing some not very flattering stories. So when it was burned, several people, some real estate people, some business people, the Tribune, they started pushing the idea that the black district should be moved further out of town. And so they went to the black property owners with the proposition that this group would sell them lots further out to build their homes, and they would be provided with sewers and public transportation and all this stuff, things they didn't actually have in Greenwood, by the way, and if they would move. But the catch was, is that they had to move before they got the money for their property that had been burned. And the black property owners got together and said, no, we're not going to do that. We want our money up front, and we want to be paid for, you know, the full value.
Right.
This group didn't have the resources to do that. They didn't have the money. And for whatever reason, the people who did have money in Tulsa apparently decided they weren't going to back this. So they didn't. But what happened, there was a big falling out between the city commission and the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce was against this scheme. The city commission was for it. City commission then extended the city limits to include all of the what was called the burn district. And by doing that, they put it under the fire code, which meant, you know, they had to build what were considered fireproof buildings. And it was believed that this would prevent them from rebuilding. Well, several things happened. One was that, to their surprise, they found out that some of the black property owners did have the access to money or credit to start rebuilding immediately, and they did. And then there were others who just started rebuilding whether they had permission to do it or not. And apparently they did a lot of it at night. There was one story where the city building inspector, apparently there was only one, was being chastised for allowing these structures to go up in the burn district. And his response was, well, I work 8 to 5. They're not doing anything 8 to 5. When I come back, I leave at 5 o'clock in the evening. And when I come back in the morning, they put up another, they put up another house or, you know, whatever it was. And so several of the property owners brought lawsuits against the city. And essentially what they argued was that this was done, that the expansion of the fire code was done not in the interest of public safety, but to take the property. And there were black and white attorneys representing them on this. It went to all three county judges, heard it at the same time, late August. They ruled in favor of the black property owners. And that was pretty much the end of the removal scheme. And then building began pretty, you know, in real earnest after that.
What was the prevailing feeling about why they stayed? I guess that was my first thought is, why stay and rebuild?
Would you stay?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very, very good point. And I, you know, you ask that, and I think, you know, in some cases, I think it was just, well, if I leave, and I, especially the property owners, if I leave, I'm going to have to, you know, give up this little bit of property that I've worked for years to acquire, and for, you know, probably almost nothing, you know, because it would be a sold under duress. Some of them had good jobs they didn't want to give up. In some cases, they had employers who helped them or even let them come and live with them. There were also people, black people, who moved to Tulsa after massacre because there were opportunities here. I mean, there was a lot of construction going on. And so, I mean, I know one fairly prominent or very prominent family in Tulsa, they moved here. They had one uncle here, or there was one man who lived here, and he told, you know, the rest of the family, hey, come on, we got a lot of work to do. And they moved to Tulsa from South Carolina and, you know, worked in the construction trades.
Wow.
And eventually branched into other things. So, you know, there was still opportunity here. I don't know if it says anything about what the rest of the country was like at that time for black people, that they would rather stay in a place where they, you know, got burned out and shot at. But
they had literally just watched firing squads come across their city lines, shooting anybody who was resisting them, and then setting the whole place on fire. And their first reaction is, hey, come on over. There's a lot of opportunity here. We're building. That just speaks to the resiliency of it. I mean, that's just amazing to me.
You know, I think these folks are awfully amazing, both before and after, because as I got into this and I realized just how, you know, I don't think most of us realize that in a lot of places in America in the 19-teens and 1920s, black people, their existence was still not that much different than slavery.
Yeah.
And in fact, And in fact, while all of this was going on, or shortly before it, the former governor of, I think it was Florida, was arrested for slavery. He had slaves on his farm, on his plantation.
Well, it was only maybe one generation, right? Less than 60 years from the emancipation, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, it's,
yeah. So, I mean, it was a real, in many cases they were, you know, there's a story about 16 tons about the guys working in the coal mines and they owe their soul to the company store, yeah, and all that stuff. Yeah. In a lot of cases, black people working on, who worked on farms and plantations and stuff like that, it was the same thing. They were theoretically free, but they were kept on the land by, you know, what was called debt peonage and things like that. So they came to a place like Tulsa, and they just did everything they could to make something they could be proud of. And many of them worked at more than one thing. One of the big property owners was a guy named Jim Cherry. And if you go through the city directory, in various years, he's listed as a plumber, a grocery store owner, a real estate guy. He was a deputy sheriff for a while. And then he owned property. I mean, the people who were kind of the core of the community, they seem to have made their money by, you know, they got there early, they bought property, they saved their money,
right?
They bought more property, they built rental property, and you know, they really worked hard, and that's one of the things that makes the whole story so heartbreaking.
What has been the lasting impact of that event on the people of Tulsa? Has there been, I mean, there has to be some type of residual impact of that in just their collective history.
Well, I would say one thing, and I don't know how this compares to other cities, but there is a lingering deep distrust of, yeah, the city's black population, of city government, of white people. And there's also to this day a real sense of ownership of that Greenwood and Archer area, and there's some pretty fierce fights over that still, and so that's part of it. I think, you know, one thing that happened was that it tended to drive blacks and whites further apart, you know, when it happened,
yeah,
and it's taken a long time to start to patch that up. You know, in some ways, I think people, especially black people, they look at the totality of their situation if they're unhappy, and they blame it on that event. And it may, in fact, have very little to do with that event. And mm-hmm. You can make an argument that that event is only the most obvious manifestation of, you know, a continuum of things. There's a big distrust of police. Now, I know that's everywhere, but I mean, that's something that's been here throughout.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's consciously tied to that, but sometimes these social attitudes get passed along without,
right,
reasons for the attitudes. In other words, it's not necessarily, we don't trust the police because they burned our place down 100 years ago. It's just, you don't trust the police.
Yeah.
And
ultimately you lose the actual reason. You just retain the feeling.
And
yeah,
you find new reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and some of them are valid and some of them may not be valid. I know, you know, I mean, we, and this works for everybody. We all sometimes see what we expect to see or what we want to see.
There was about 1997, I believe, something like that, late 90s commission that examined the event in Tulsa, right? And the final determination was that the city of Tulsa was culpable for the damage and the destruction. And they were talking about reparations or some type of payment or making the survivors of those families repayment for their loss. Was anything actually ever come of that? I think that was the suggestion at the time, but did anything actually come of it?
Not really. I mean, there was a group that was mainly the Unitarians came in and gave the, and there were actually probably 100 or so survivors still alive at that time. And it was only to the survivors.
Yeah.
And then the Chamber of Commerce, there were some people in the Chamber of Commerce that were talking about trying to make some kind of a payment, settlement, whatever you want to call it, privately. You know, this would not be done by the city of Tulsa. It'd be done by, you know, through private contributions, if you will. And so then in 2003, a group of lawyers came in and filed a lawsuit on behalf of survivors and families. And that caused a lot of hard feelings. And that, so that thing, that effort ended. Nothing came of the lawsuit. And so that's where we are today. It, you know, with the centennial coming, it's been, that's been taken back up. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, so the idea for the commission back in the late 90s actually originated with something that was done in Florida, which was the investigation into the Rosewood incident. So, and I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
No, I'm not.
Okay, so there was this incident similar to this in Florida in a rural coastal area. There was a little settlement called Rosewood. It was a black community. And basically there was a war between it and an adjoining white community. And the black community wound up, you know, disappearing, basically. And the whole story was... brought back up, I think, by an Orlando Sentinel reporter. I don't remember when he first started writing about it, but at any rate, it led to some action in the Florida legislature. Florida was a lot more Democrat in those days, and it led to some action where those families received some payments. And so that kind of sparked the idea of that and some compensation to the Japanese who'd been interned during World War II. So that kind of led to, you know, what happened as far as getting a commission in Oklahoma.
Well, one of my questions, and because I'm from Ohio, and I had never heard of that this ever before in Ohio. But obviously, it is something that is at least part of the consciousness in Tulsa. It may not maybe necessarily be taught in the history class in school. I don't know if it is or not. But at least it does come up. And we are coming up on 100 years now since the event, May 31st of this year. Is there some type of memorial service scheduled? Or is there something to commemorate that event?
Yeah, so there's centennial plans going on, and they've been a little bit close to the vest about that. I think they're hoping to get some pretty big names to participate. But at any rate, they're in the process of building a history center for Greenwood that would include, it would include the massacre, but the objective is to really cover the entire history of that community. Because there is a lot of pride in the successes of Greenwood. They don't really want it to be all about, you know, getting burned down and people killed and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I thank you very much, Randy, for joining me tonight. It was as interesting as I thought it would be. And it speaks to just the issue we're having right now, where if some aspect of history offends someone, we have to erase it and we have to not be able to think about it again for our own, you know, it makes us feel better. Whereas I think that those things personally, it should be every now and then, you know, you should touch on them again just to validate that, yes, it did happen. Yes, bad things do happen and we can learn and grow and go forward from it rather than just basically erasing things from existence. I appreciate you spending the time with me tonight. And is there anything else that you are currently working on that you'd like to take a moment and plug before we go?
No, not really. I mean, mostly I'm working on the Oklahoma legislature right now. So that's keeping me pretty busy, and I don't know if I'll be, you know, I am also covering stuff related to the centennial and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I like for people to not only pay attention to this, but realize that this sort of thing happened all over the country.
Right, exactly.
And I mean, you mentioned Ohio. I don't know of anything specific to Ohio, but you know, there was a big lynching in Duluth, Minnesota, for crying out loud. So I mean, this stuff happened all over, and it, although we tend to think of it mainly as involving blacks, you know, in the Western United States, it also involved Chinese and other Asians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is something that I think we tended to not want to address.
Right.
And it's something that I think we all have to come to terms with. And I'm not just talking about white America. I think everybody has to come to terms with it.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, for sure. Well, once again, Randy Crable, you can find more about Randy at his website, randycrable.com, and his book, Tulsa 1921, Reporting a Massacre. You can find that on Amazon as well. Thank you so much, Randy, for joining me. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a great evening.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, there we go. We had a history lesson tonight, and like I said, I did not know anything about it. And I'm sure there are hundreds of episodes just like this one that aren't taught historically to young children growing up. But it just calls into question, what is history? History really is what's written. If nobody writes about it, nobody provides this oral tradition or a written tradition of an event, then it didn't happen. Suddenly it's no longer there. You know, people will remember it for a bit. But eventually people pass on. And then if we don't have those written histories listed and taught, if we don't remember the past, we're doomed to repeat it. And I just found it such an incredible story that one section of town, a white section of town, could just kind of walk into the other section of town with the National Guard and shoot at people. And the American government shooting people and killing them. And it just kind of brings us back, you know, in some small way to where we are right now, where there was this constant cloud over the heads of the people in the United States, unrest for the last year or so. And let's destroy the things that make us feel bad. Let's destroy the things that make us think or make us uncomfortable, even a little bit. Let's just get rid of them and wipe them away so that we don't have to think critically about what happened. And I was interested to find out the story and find out exactly, there were precipitating events on both sides. You know, there were individuals that came to the sheriff's department for Dick Rowland, and they were armed. Maybe they shouldn't have been. Maybe that them being armed inflamed an already pretty hostile situation. There are ways to learn from all of that. Should the National Guard and the white citizens have come across the city line and started shooting people? Hell no, obviously not. Should they have been held accountable after they did? Yes, they should have. Should the people who burned the city down been held accountable for that? You obviously knew who they were. You identified them as being police officers. If you know the police officers, how many police officers are there? Why not just throw them all up in a lineup and say, which one of these police officers did you see? There are 7 of them that they identified originally, but they just can't remember their name. There are ways to make this happen. They obviously had no desire to make this happen, so it didn't. And so, you know, then the newspapers are covering this primarily from the white point of view, you know, the black antagonizers, and there is no other counterpoint to that. And so that is where it's unfortunate that the quote-unquote fake news been around forever. News has been the vessel of miscommunication and misdirection and misinformation forever. They write what they are told to write. They don't necessarily write what the actual events are in a dispassionate way. Everybody has bias. So do reporters. So do people who put the news together and they provide it to you. Eventually, that becomes the truth. I think I've said it before. If you keep saying something loud enough and long enough, that becomes the truth. So people like Randy coming in and writing a book about what happened reviewing and researching the news coverage of the time to see how it was it overly biased, was it reliable, what could it have been deemed reliable for the events that occurred, and then what did some of the black publications of the time, what was their side of that story, and how did they differ, and was the truth somewhere in between? Probably, usually, the truth is somewhere in between the two stories, but we can't just brush them under the rug. That's my point to it. That's the reason we had this history lesson tonight. That's the reason I found this to be incredibly interesting and something I would recommend for all of you to read. Tulsa 1921, reporting a massacre. 300 people, upwards of 300, maybe 500 people out of 7,000 were killed. So you have anywhere from, you know, 4.5% to, I don't know, 5-6% of the population was killed. And many of them fled. A lot of them never came back. A lot of the big money people that started the city left and didn't come back. To their credit, they were able to rebuild it. And I found that to be amazing. They're amazingly resilient that they were able to build that back up after they had been burned down. I don't know many people who would say, okay, you've come in and completely destroyed my life. I'm going to stay here next to you and rebuild it. That's an incredible statement. What are your thoughts? You can contact us on our Gmail account. It's provemewrongcast@gmail.com. Or you can contact us on the comment section on YouTube, comment section on Rumble, comment section on our podcast platform itself. Let us know what you think. We should not run from them. We should not sweep them under the rug. We should revisit them, feel the shame rightly, and move on and be a better person going forward. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/provemewrong. If you are looking for ways to listen to the podcast itself, you can find us on any number of podcast platforms, Stitcher, SoundCloud, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, iTunes, any platform that you use to listen to podcasts, you can find the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Like and subscribe to the show, and you'll be notified when a brand new episode releases. We typically release one every week. Click on notifications. You'll be notified on your phone when a brand new episode is released, and you can be the first on your block to listen to the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Like I mentioned before, we also have a YouTube account and a Rumble account. YouTube.com/provemewrong, Rumble.com/provemewrong. Like and subscribe, hit the notification bell. You will be notified when a brand new episode releases, and you can actually watch the video portion of the show. If you are listening to the audio right now, I did have a video of Randy and myself discussing his book. I did have a screenshot of the book up on the screen at certain points, so you can see what it looks like. If you're looking for it, you can find it on Amazon.com. Also, if you like the work that we do here with the Prove Me Wrong podcast and you would like to support us, we have a Patreon account as well. It's patreon.com/PMW podcast. If you become a patron to the PMW podcast, you have additional content available to you that is not currently published on our podcast or our video platforms, and you will be ahead of the game. We have a specific content just for patrons. Once again, patreon.com/PMW podcast. And you'd like to support us, we would certainly appreciate that. Before we go tonight, I did want to say that our sponsor tonight are Zendo Zone Citronella Candles from JT Eaton. And here is my Zendo Zone right there. They are shaped like fearless bug repellent tiki gods. See, it's a tiki god. So let Surf and Stan, Hawaiian Howie, and Luau Lily bring the islands to your backyard with Zendo Zone Citronella Burners. They use natural 3% citronella candles and incense cones, and they're perfect for patios, decks, backyards, campsites, poolside, and more. You can enjoy the outdoors again. They are available on Amazon.com and at select Ace Hardware stores. Go ahead and pick yours up today. Once again, Randy Crable was my guest tonight. His book is Tulsa 1921, Reporting a Massacre. Look it up, folks. It's history. My name is Pete Lieb. This is the Prove Me Wrong podcast, and I hope to see you again soon.